Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oklahoma City-based Dead Center Film Festival is expanding to Tulsa with a two-day mini-festival this Friday and Saturday at the Circle Cinema. One of the films will mark the first feature by a group of former Tulsans. Production and costume designer Katie Irish, actor Kent Meister, and director Jonathan Scott Chin all met at the University of Tulsa in the late 1990s. Back for several years, Chin was an employee at KWGS and producer of this program. Now in New York and joined by writer-actor Richard Lovejoy, they put together Charred Oak Films. After a couple of short films, the quartet have produced their first feature film, a quirky comedy drama on a very somber subject, the mourning process in The Widowers. The film follows lifelong friends Jake and Jonathan who lost their wives in an auto accident. While Jonathan seems to have moved on, Jake can't seem to overcome his paralyzing grief. So the two leave for the country and a weekend at an ill-conceived grief counseling workshop with a counselor well outside of her depth and a group of attendees ranging from catatonic to sociopathic. My guest today is director Jonathan Scott Chin. As I mentioned, he was producer of Studio Tulsa from 1999 to 2001, was active in local and regional theater here in Oklahoma. Since moving to New York, he has produced and directed a number of award-winning commercials and digital content for clients ranging from Puma, American Express, Smirnoff, GM, to UNICEF. And as a part of Charred Oak, he's directed two shorts, The Ballad of Lance and Bill and the Scientists, and several music videos. The Widowers will show this Friday evening at 9 o'clock as a part of the Dead Center Film Festival at the Circle Cinema. Scott Chin, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Rich.
And for longtime listeners of this show, they'll know that at one point you were a producer for Studio Tulsa, but you've been in New York for a long time and been making films, making commercials and short films, and now your first feature. What led into making this first feature?
Well, it's interesting to talk about now because it's something that I have wanted to do since childhood. It's kind of like been the one thing I've always wanted to do, so it's very odd to talk about having done it now that it's out in the world, but I guess you could say I've been trying to make a feature film for 20 years, but it was only about 5 years ago when I started to meet the right group of people that it all started to come together. And those people essentially are my wife, Katie, and my other two business partners, Richard Lovejoy and Kent Meister. We comprise Charred Oak Films. We got together about 5 years ago with the intention to make a horror comedy, which we spent some considerable time on, but never quite came together because of largely money issues. So we scaled way back down and tried to make a different horror comedy that was actually going to be called Satan Camp. It was a very tongue-in-cheek sort of spoof of sort of 80s satanic slasher flicks that was designed to be incredibly low budget. That kind of had legs for a while. We had some sort of B-level stars that would be fun to have in the film and would be kind of marketable. We're talking to John Carpenter about being an executive producer for a while. We had some money, but it was contingent on other money. Basically, it's really hard to put together a feature film when you haven't made one before, and that actually kind of fell apart after a while as well. So we set out to create a project that, in its genesis, was not coming from the most creative of places. It all started because we said, we need a project that we can make for about couple hundred thousand dollars that we can definitely find the money for, that we know we can manage. It was extremely practical reasons that The Widowers came about. But over the course of working on it for almost four years, from the beginning honing the script to post-production and sending out on the festival circuit, it's really turned into something that feels absolutely like the movie that we were always meant to make, and it means a huge deal to me. I mean, it's so personal and it's so important, which is really surprising when you consider that we started working on it purely because it was a practical thing to achieve. But it all worked out in the end.
And it's about as far away from those slasher camp films that you were talking about as you can get, because this is it's a really, really interesting story of a group of widowers who come together for a weekend, and two in particular who are connected. Their wives died. They were friends for life. Their wives died in a car accident, and they're dealing with being a widower. Richard Lovejoy, who's one of the principals, and he's also the writer of the feature, how did this idea begin percolating for him?
He's had this idea sitting on a table and written in some various form or another for almost a decade, actually. He came up with the idea not through any particular inspiration from his own life, other than the fact that Rich is just a really fruitful writer. He is just full of ideas. He's one of those writers who, contrary to some writers where any material is like squeezing blood from a stone, the challenge with Rich is actually picking through the multitude of interesting things and finding out where the really meaningful idea is, because he's just so full of ideas. But this is one that he likes to say was with him for a long time, but he kind of had to live enough of a life to get into a place that he was ready to write it. He wrote it as a short film version some time ago on a weekend writing retreat with some people. Kent was involved in that weekend. I was not. I didn't even know Rich at the time. And it's something he picked up off the pile that all writers keep when we decided we wanted to come up with something that we thought was achievable in terms of budget. And it is very different from what we had been doing in terms of the horror comedies and the sort of spoof slasher flicks. There are some similarities. You wouldn't think of it on the surface, really, but the strange as it may seem, the verbal wit of Rich's writing is certainly a connection between the two. And the use of humor to deal with really dark and very true human themes definitely runs through the two. Although, of course, by making it not a horror film, you're stripping away that whole construction of genre. So without that genre, you know, structure, even though it's still quite a funny film, gets you much closer to the actual human experience and kind of requires you to actually have a stronger point of view and know more what you're trying to say about, you know, the grief process and what it's like to grieve and what it's like to experience tragic loss. So I would say it's a higher degree of difficulty to make an interesting film that has truth to it when you take away the construct of it being a horror movie or a crime thriller or a straight comedy. And I'm glad we did that. We all agree that although it's not by any, none of this was planned to turn out this way, but we are lucky that we ended up with a film that really feels like it's the film that we should have made and that we wanted to make. And it means a lot to us.
Well, you're treading on that fine line, but you know, that comedy drama line. And sometimes it feels like it's a little dramatic for a comedy and a little light for a straight drama, but it's kind of treading both sides of the line at the same time. That's a very difficult fine line to find.
Yeah, it was one of my primary challenges as a director when we started working on the script is finding the right tone. And you're right, it's challenging territory. But what I knew was necessary to make the film work was getting that tone right. And there were a lot of choices that we made before we ever got on set about the script, about how much irreverent comedy can this film contain before people no longer take it seriously. I think that's more dangerous than getting too too serious, because the subject matter, you're going to get to some dark places given the story, especially when you have, you know, actors in the room and you put it all together with real people and their real experiences and emotions. And I think that's easier to manage than the comedy part. The comedy part's actually much harder, because when you have a script like this, it has actual jokes in it, like not just humorous situations, but real good old-fashioned sort of, you know, 1-2-3-beat jokes, verbal wits, there's drug humor, there's sex humor. I mean, it really goes pretty far afield the way that Rich wrote the script and the things that we wanted to include. So how do you contain all that in the film, but still keep a world where the audience is going to take the characters seriously and be able to go with them on their journeys and feel the pain and really think about grief, because that's what we wanted. And it really can come down to one joke being in the script or not, or cutting out of a scene, you know, 5 seconds earlier than not. And I'm proud of where we ended up by the time that the film was finished, but you're right, an extremely fine line, because if one joke goes too far or one thing tries a bit too hard and feels like the humor isn't coming out of the situation and the character, and it starts to feel like a joke for a joke's sake, that's when you're then no longer able to keep the audience with you when you get to the real depths of suffering and moments that you need to play absolutely straight and really, you know, feel the pathos of what's going on.
It's funny you should mention that, because the joke parts, you know, they were funny, but they were, I found the funniest parts were these very dry lines and dry asides and dry, well, just a camera shot that would, I found that to be the funniest part of the film, was these very subtle attempts at humor, which I thought were some of the funniest parts of the film.
People have often asked, I mean, why is this a comedy? And I don't know, it just seems to me, especially having been through tragic loss myself,
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot about grieving, and there's a lot about being a person who's in deep pain, living in the modern world, that is really very funny. And it's very funny because it's very absurd. And this is something that it was really important to me to come across in the film, is that people who are suffering and who have been unmoored so profoundly from what they expected out of life, and this is, you know, every loss is painful and sad and tragic, but there's a difference when you unexpectedly lose your living life partner or a child or someone to a tragic, completely unexpected accident. It's not someone who's toward the end of their life, and it's a bit more sort of, it's on the path that we all expect and we all understand, and you know, society as a whole is somewhat more supportive of you for it. But when something really tragic happens, generally as a culture, we're not very prepared for it. And the overriding messages that people hear are about healing, about moving on, and about how to get past this thing, when in fact, what we found and what we really tried to make come across in the Widowers, particularly with the character of Jake, who's sort of the primary focus character, the one who's really not recovering, not able to move on, really quite depressed. Sometimes when you've lost someone so suddenly, like, that grief, like, your process and your pain is the last thing you have of them. So you don't want to let it go. You don't want to move on or start to experience life to its fullest, because you've lost that person and your loss of them is all that you have left to cling to. And that sort of gives your life purpose. And the way that a person who is in that state of mind fits into, you know, everyday life in America in the 21st century is, you know, not very well, not very well at all. There's constant moments of the most mundane situations where the absurdity of one person feeling that way, but the expectations of them from the people they're surrounded by being so unrealistic and just so not in tune with what's happening to them, that's the source of the comedy for me, because it's absurd and tragic, but also very ironic. And there's just, yeah, there's a lot of moments, like you say, where just the framing of it with the camera, honing in on a particular little detail, largely Pam, the counselor at this grief retreat that the widowers have gone to attend, she is sort of the embodiment of the what I call the grief industry,
right.
the healing industry, all these people who have created businesses and industry out of coping and healing and that sort of thing. And she's the embodiment of that. She's a character who has suffered her own loss. She lost her husband very early in life after they'd been married only a few years. And without really doing much self-examination at all, it seems, she has very ill-advisedly, you know, started this program where she is gunning hard to help other people who've also had their own loss. And she's all about moving on and healing. And it's, as you would see in the film, it's not necessarily always as productive or as positive as it seems to push people in that direction.
I thought, and that's played by Jennifer Williams, who's, again, an Oklahoma native, and I thought that was the trickiest role, because she's this face of absurdity, and yet she has to be enough somewhat grounded to actually be believable in trying to help people. And I thought she had a very, very, it was a very, very tricky role, which she pulled off pretty well, I think.
I agree. It's a real high-wire act, that role. I always like to say that when we wrote the script, when Kent and myself were sort of giving a lot of notes and helping to shape the final shooting script with Rich, we talked a lot about how Pam was a very successful concept on paper, but I always had real concerns about how we were going to turn her into an actual human being on screen, because she does represent a lot of things. She's also the machine that drives a lot of what happens in the film. And she does a lot of things that are so beyond questionable, they turn, as you say, they turn into just sheerly absurd. And to find someone to play that role and really turn it into a recognizable human you even start to care for and have sympathy for is really quite a feat. And I knew at the first reading when we met Jem that she was going to be the right choice. We cast for more than a year for all of the roles in the film, but the longest stretch, almost the entire year, we were sort of looking for and not committing to someone to play Pam. We looked at women who were older, women who were younger, bigger, smaller, all sorts of different types. Jen is the one who really brought to it an ability to play that comedy, technically. Like, she could do the chirpy, good morning, silly stuff really well. And she had the comic timing, and she had the natural sort of intensity of action and movement and never settling or standing still or really reflecting on anything that the character needed. But when she was able to just be still for a moment, she really had pain in her eyes, and she has that weight in her. And that was something that was, I didn't know if we were going to find it, and I'm so glad that we did. I think the movie works because of that.
Well, I was going to say there's one scene in particular where it's towards the end of the movie, and she actually does a moment of reflection on what all of the characters who have come to her little seminar are trying to do in their own way. And she actually has this moment of reflection, and you actually see that, well, she's right in the same place as the rest of them.
That's true. It was everyone is pretty helpless in the face of a sudden and tragic loss. And that was important that we reveal that Pam, who in many ways can come across like a monster.
Right.
And in fact, audiences have been pretty divided on her. I mean, generally there's sympathy, and she's something of an antihero for sure. But there are some people who just have a viscerally strong negative reaction to the character of Pam, which I think is a good thing, because, I mean, they should. Jen and I always talk. She always really, Jen's approach was that Pam as a character was so understandable, and all these horrible things that she does, which in the film, I won't give anything away, but she crosses many lines and boundaries, and she definitely makes some damaging, poor choices. And does some very terrifying things, not to mention the fact that her entire approach is largely misguided, if occasionally effective, almost by accident. But some people, just the moment she begins talking, they just, like, the hair on the back of their neck stands up, and they just can barely stand watching her, which I think is really interesting. Jen always thought that she was such a sympathetic character, and she came by all this honestly, and she was the lead. And I, as the director, was always like, I'm terrified of you when you're playing. Like, every time you're on camera, you send chills down my spine, particularly when she's smiling and really encouraging her charges, you know, along that path to healing. That was the stuff that I actually found most disturbing, is when she was just so bright and willfully cheerful throughout all of these really heavy scenes of discussion of, you know, the spouses that people had lost and how they were feeling and how they were coping, which, you know, I've come across in real life fairly often as well, this strange disassociation between the subject matter at hand and sort of people's demeanor as they're dealing with it. I like to say that if this were a horror movie, The Widowers, Pam would definitely be the monster. She would be like the Freddy Krueger or the Michael Myers of this film.
Killing people with inspirational poems and posters.
Yeah, absolutely.
My guest today is Jonathan Scott Chin. He's the director of the new feature film, The Widowers, which will be shown this Friday at 9 o'clock as part of the Dead Center Film Festival in Tulsa. That's going on all this weekend at the Circle Cinema, Friday and Saturday. And if you remember the name, he used to be a producer for Studio Tulsa back around 1999, 2000, and been living in New York. And I mentioned that Jen Williams was an Oklahoman, and you have a whole group of expatriate Okies up in New York that are making this film together. Kent Meister, your wife, Katie Irish, who's the costume designer and a producer. You another Oklahoman doing music. This is a whole group of Okies in New York.
It's
with
true.
Chart Oak.
Yeah, there's a strong Oklahoma connection with this group. It's, my relatively long, at this point, life has taught me one thing, and that's that Oklahomans who are not in Oklahoma tend to gather around one another almost inadvertently. I just find myself surrounded by Oklahomans working in film up here. There were people who worked on the film who I didn't even realize were from Oklahoma until several months into it, including some members of our crew. And it's great to have that. I mean, but I feel like it's, you know, there are a lot of different people from different parts of the world who worked on the film as well. But people have asked if there's something about the film that has an Oklahoma sensibility. And I don't know how to answer that other than to say that a lot of Oklahomans helped make it. I think there's something to be said for that wry sense of humor that you mentioned that you picked up on in the film that I think has something to do with the Oklahoma character. There is an Oklahoma sense of humor, and it is somewhat self-deprecating while being somewhat ironic at the same time. And I think maybe that may come into play in the film.
Now, your two main characters, Jake and Jonathan, which are, again, two of your principals of your film company, Richard Lovejoy and Kent Meister. How important was it that you have this? I would assume it's a pretty close relationship after doing things together for the last 5, 6, 7 years in establishing their rapport and relationship, because they've been in a couple of your shorts. And of course, Richard usually writes most of the material, too.
Yeah, it is a very close relationship. I mean, the characters were written for Rich and Kent to play specifically. I mean, they had a relationship that predates me, actually. Kent and Rich knew each other before I had ever met Rich, and they had done a fair amount of theater together. They'd performed together on stage, and, of course, they had done some short films with me. And that was a big advantage to me as a director, for sure, because I didn't have to establish a lifelong friendship between two strangers on camera. That part came naturally. So that was one thing I was thankful for and put in my kit bag and just coasted on and focused on all of the other challenges at play. But yeah, it's a very natural relationship. I think that comes across on screen. They're very comfortable with one another, and there's a lot immediately apparent but unspoken when they appear together on camera, which is important for the film to work, because the character of Jake is essentially a passive protagonist, which is one of the many rules that we broke with this script. They tell you never to do that. Never make your protagonist someone who isn't doing anything to change the situation, because it's boring. Well, we broke that rule, for sure. We also have what a lot of people would call a non-traditional ending. We don't really give a lot of resolution to what happens to people, but again, I think it's very true to the subject matter. I wanted to conscientiously avoid trying to create a sense of false resolution. It seems to be sort of going against one of the very things that we were talking about grief counseling and its shortcomings in setting timetables and milestones for people who are grieving, which is not necessarily the most healthy approach to it. But Jake, as a character, is someone who spends most of the film struggling but incapable to rise above his grief. And I think that the relationship between the two actors, Kent and Rich, made that relationship on screen between Jake and Jonathan be more interesting to watch, especially when Jake wasn't doing much but sitting there and it was all about Jonathan dragging him to this counseling retreat, encouraging him to talk, trying to push him to open up and to talk and to try to make something out of the life that they're still living. If it were two actors who didn't know one another and had no relationship, I think it would have been a lot more challenging to indicate that there was something there that you weren't necessarily seeing yet. I think people give you a longer leash because they can tell that there's some content that they're interested in finding out what it is. There's some sort of mystery to the bones of this relationship, which of course you find out eventually in the film.
Right. You know, I have to dispute a little bit. I think actually Richard Lovejoy's character, Jake, is the one that does find more resolution than just about anybody else in the film. I mean, you have these wonderful scenes where each of the characters are going back to their home after spending this weekend in the Catskills. And to me, I mean, it was very subtle, but I thought that that character had moved on and had resolved a few things. I guess I didn't get it.
No, that is a valid reading of the film. One of the things that Rich and I talk about a lot is we cherish the varied reactions and interpretations that people have when watching a movie. Those are the types of movies that we like, movies that you are not collared into an understanding of exactly what is going on. And especially for a film like this, I think there is a richness to it that is much more palpable when you're not forcing the audience to see it the exact same way that you do. I mean, you're right. What happens to Jake in the film is that he is somewhat inert and stuck, and then he becomes somewhat unstuck through a series of mostly unpleasant events at this grief counseling retreat. But in the end, he goes back to New York and he has to face continuing to live and precisely what you think that life is going to be like and whether you think he's, you know, as they always say in, you know, story classes, like, has he learned anything or has he grown as a character? I mean, that's up for debate. And I think it's really, it all works. It's an ensemble film. And what we wanted to create is this world where Jake and Jonathan are our protagonists. Pam is something of an anti-hero, but also an antagonist. She has her own grief issues to deal with. Then there are all these great supporting characters, and they all end up in a slightly different place. Some of them seem to have gotten worse. Some of them seem like maybe they are taking a few more steps to some kind of more positive and workable day-to-day existence. And some of them, it's very hard to say. And that was important that was how we left the film, that it wasn't tied up in a neat little bow. But there was a lot to interpret and discuss about grief and marriage also, and which is another theme running throughout the film. It's not just about death or grieving. There's a lot in the movie about marriage, seen through the, you know, unusual lens of grief.
Yeah, no, the other thing I was going to mention was you made this film for a couple hundred thousand dollars. It does not look like a couple hundred thousand dollar film. It's a beautifully shot film. We haven't mentioned your cinematographer, but there are some beautiful, beautiful shots. And you're on location, I assume, someplace in the Catskills or someplace resembling the Catskills. And it's just a beautiful cinematography.
Thank you. Yeah, I love the way the film looks, too. Our cinematographer is Christine Ng. She is a wonderful cinematographer. It's her first feature film as well. She shot a lot of commercials, music videos, and she has been the camera operator for Lance Accord and other lights of the cinematography world. You know, our film is a low budget, but it was very important to me and to all of us that it was produced well and we were spending that money in a way that was on screen. You know, a lot of low budget films get by with what they have. A great story is obviously the most important thing, but past that, film is a visual medium, and it was really important to us that the film looked great, sounded great, had a good production design. They're all important, you know, tools in telling the story. We did shoot a very accelerated schedule. We shot 15 days in upstate New York in a town called Eldred, New York. It's an extremely small town, very remote. Any film producer will tell you it's the worst possible idea for your first feature. You go to some remote rural place so you have to pay to put everybody up in motels, and you have to pay for food, and you have to bring it all in, and they're right. It was a giant nightmare. But we had to do it, and it created this atmosphere of like a movie camp kind of atmosphere. We were all staying in this small town. There was nothing to do on the off hours. It was all about the film. Everyone was getting to know one another, cast and crew. It was an intense experience, but I think, I don't know, it stirred up a lot of closeness and emotion that I think just sort of helped drive what was happening on screen.
Well, you can see the results in The Widowers, which will be shown this Friday at 9 o'clock at the Circle Cinema as a part of the Dead Center Film Festival in Tulsa. Of course, that's an Oklahoma City Film Festival in the summer, but they're doing a mini festival this weekend, Friday and Saturday. Scott, it's a pleasure to talk with you again, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Scott Chin speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The former Studio Tulsa producer is now the director of his first feature film, The Widowers, which will be showing Friday evening at 9 o'clock at the Circle Cinema as a part of the Dead Center Film Festival in Tulsa. That takes place all evening Friday and all day Saturday at the Circle Cinema. Visit CircleCinema.com for showtime information. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.